Hello, and welcome to So You Think You Can Rule Persia? The podcast where we rate and review all the kings of Persia from Diocles to Yazdegerd III. I am Sariel, and my pronouns are they, them.
I'm Umberto, and my pronouns are he, him. So, as you probably know, this podcast is part of the wonderful RexyPod family started by Rex Factor, and this is going to follow a similar format. So every week I'll be researching the life of a certain ruler of Persia, and then I will present my research to Sariel, and together we'll talk about anything that sticks out to us and comment on anything interesting that we find along the way.
Essentially, he does all the work and I get to react to it, which is not very fair, but thank you very much for doing all the research, and I promise an honest opinion and hopefully a fun conversation.
Yes, it's not going to be fair, but it's going to be fun, so that's fine. It works. So yeah, at the end of the lives of these kings, we're both going to review them using some categories that we're going to tell you a little bit later on. And at the end of all this, we're going to find if the king in question is worthy of being called a Shahanshah or a Shahanah. That is to say, if they are a king of kings or not. Which, given that this was a title that Persian kings use a lot, it seemed an apt thing to use. So the podcast is going to be semi-serious in nature, since we're going to be looking at all these kings, but it won't really be like a textbook sort of thing. It's more like, you know, having a beer with a friend who's studied this stuff and wants to tell you about it and has cornered you in a room for 1 hour, so you're trapped here and you have to listen. But yeah.
Well, you know, I am very happy to listen. You didn't corner me in a room. Please send help. So if this is something you might be interested in, please stay with us. Share the conversation.
Also, just to make it clear, we are not professionals or
in
historians.
In any way, shape, or form.
I am just a person who thought, hey, this would be cool. I'll pick up a book and tell people about it. So, you know, if you want to do more research into stuff, I'll put my sources in the show notes and you can read more if you're interested.
Do your own research, you lazy.
So now on to a little bit more technical details about names and things, because names are weird and generally have many interpretations, so I'd like to point out what we're going to be using.
Here's a few words that you might hear in this podcast.
So those of you who have been reading ahead might know that the concept of Persia is fluid and sometimes doesn't exist throughout history. So what are we going to use as rulers of Persia when Persia doesn't exist, for example? Well, the idea that I had was essentially that since it's called So You Think You Can Rule Persia, we're going to look at whoever ruled as a legitimate king. We're going to look at whoever ruled the modern region of Persia, or Fars, as it is called in the modern day. So whoever owns this specific bit of land is going to be considered as a ruler of Persia.
And I'm sure the Persian Empire will change its shape and form many, many times throughout
yes.
our
There's going
podcast.
To be a lot of mutation going on. It's going to be an interesting time, but we can see. So this is going to allow us to have a nice unbroken chain of rulers from 700 BC to about 650-ish AD.
Oh, that's a lot of years.
Yes.
Is that 1,400 years?
It's 1,350-ish, which is nice because Persian history breaks up halfway over there. So it was convenient.
How
a convenient
neat.
Breaking point, yes. I also briefly considered skipping the brief period when Persia is going to be ruled by foreigners, essentially not by native Persians, but other foreign invaders. But I thought that that was going to be a little bit weird to just have a 200-year-old gap somewhere in the middle. And I want to know about these people as well, because they're interesting and nobody talks about them either. So
they ruled the part of land that we're interested in right now, right? So they should be part of whatever podcast we're making.
Yeah, essentially. So the little change when that's going to be happening is that we are not going to consider how good they were for their own empire, but how good they were for Persia itself. So yes, if your empire is massive and expands and does well, but you're just sapping Persia dry, then you're not doing a good job from the point of view of our podcast anyway.
Right.
But, you know, maybe you're doing an excellent job for your empire far, far away, but if Persia's burning, we're not that happy. So, yeah. Next is a comment about naming, about Persia itself and the difference between Persian and Iran. What is it? What are we going to use here in this specific case? So the idea is that Iran, or a variant of that name, depending on the local languages, was used to describe the country from the local people, often, while Persia is essentially a foreign name for the country itself, because Persia is a small part of the overall modern country of Iran, for example. And calling the nation Persia is a little bit of a misnomer, like you would call England for Great Britain or Holland for the Netherlands. It's a part for the whole, so it's not entirely correct, and it is excluding certain people who are still part of the greater country, anyway. And also in 1935, the Iranian government officially announced that they want to be called Iran rather than Persia, and that's what they want.
Probably so, we should listen to that.
Yeah, mostly because it's more inclusive of people who aren't Persian, who live in the country and are still around. So since historical texts generally refer to the country as Persia, however, that is mostly what I'll be using, as long as the texts refer to it as such. So I'll be referring to Persia as the overall empire, usually, while the actual region of modern Iran, or overall the Iranian plateau, which includes bits of Afghanistan and Pakistan, that's going to be what I will refer to as Iran for the foreseeable future, and then we'll see what happens later on. Finally, last point about the pronunciation of names, I'm going to be using the anglicized form, if it exists, mostly because if you're listening to this, you can speak English. And
you're probably English speaker.
Yeah, and if you want to look up stuff, it's easier if you know what it looks like vaguely, and it'd be easier in general.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and overall, it would be kind of weird if I just broke my English halfway into a different language that I don't speak.
Which is not going to be accurate anyway.
If instead of talking about Xerxes, I stopped halfway and said Kshayarsha, mispronouncing the real name.
And offending everyone.
I would offend everyone living and dead, so I'd rather not do that and just use the thing that I can pronounce. If instead there isn't really an agreed-upon anglicized pronunciation, I'll do my best with whatever exists and see what I can do. So that is all that we have for now as a general preamble.
Sounds good.
And we can start with a bit of an overview of human history.
I am so excited about this.
Yes, there's a lot of human history to go through, but
we've been around for a while.
Yeah, we've done a lot of things, but you know, we'll see how we finally get to the year 700 BC. We have about 9,000 years to go. We'll see how that goes. So I'll get you all up to speed on the environment that our first kings are going to inhabit.
I'll be taking notes.
Yes. So we'll see how well you can remember things across time.
Will there be a test?
Maybe.
Great.
It'll work. We'll see like halfway through what to do. So the story of the region begins, for our purposes, in around 9700 BC, when the last ice age essentially ended, and people finally got the chance to settle down and domesticate a whole lot of plants and animals. And as soon as they got the chance, pretty much all around the world, they started domesticating anything that would accept this. One of the first places where this happened was the rough area of the Middle East, what is commonly called the Fertile Crescent, which includes Egypt, the Levant, and Mesopotamia, which is roughly modern Iraq.
I've heard about Mesopotamia. It's the first culture.
Yeah, it's the first high civilization, as it is called. So essentially the first people who settle down somewhere, build cities, build empires, all the stuff we're going to talk about.
As you can tell by my tone, I am very confident of this.
Yeah. So interesting things begin to happen in the Fertile Crescent. So population begins to slowly rise as people domesticate more and more animals. So, you know, the more animals you have, the more a steady source of food you have, so the more children you can have, and the more people you can have.
Suddenly,
and the thing is that more people you have, more sheep you can herd, and so on and so forth.
Suddenly, instead of just surviving, it's living for a bit.
Yeah, it's surviving. It's, you know, instead of having to hunt for something that might not exist, you know that, okay, I have 10 sheep, I can expect they might increase, so hey, I have some sort of security with what I'm going to have.
Food, wool.
Yeah, food, wool, all
milk,
that sort of nice stuff.
Cheese, nice.
It's more secure than otherwise. So we have, in around this period, the first semi-permanent town in the world called Jericho, which is in Palestine. And it is founded in about 9600 BC. And I was very, very surprised to find out that it is still inhabited after 12,000 years.
Whoa.
And people still live there. It has about 10,000 people, I think.
That is a very successful town.
Yeah, they've, you know,
that is very
had
impressive.
A long history.
Wow. It is so it is the same Jericho. It's not just, oh, you know, there was a town, people built over it, the name changed, other people invaded.
But I mean, it is the same city. I mean, of course it was destroyed. I mean, the Bible tells us it's been destroyed a few times.
Yes, yes, but, yes.
You know, people are living in the same place, calling it the same name, and roughly the same people,
you
would assume.
That's very impressive that the name stayed.
It's surprising, but I imagine that it probably wasn't the original name. But to be fair, no one knows since this is still firmly prehistory.
I wasn't there, I can't tell you.
Well, you know, if someone was there, please write in and tell us. But we'll see what happens.
Time Lords, please.
So yeah, so this was still a semi-permanent settlement. So the idea was that early agriculture generally works that you plant some seeds in an area and then you leave to herd your sheep somewhere else where it's more comfortable for whatever animals you have. Then you come back when it's time to reap what you've sown.
You check
and then you find, oh, okay, cool. It worked out. It didn't work out. It's not a huge investment of time and resources.
You just let nature do its thing instead of micromanaging every
part. Essentially, since these plants are native from the area anyway, they were going to grow there. You're just planting them more in a certain place. So we'll see what happens.
Interesting.
But then in about 9000 BC, we get the first proto-religious site on Earth at Göbekli Tepe in southern Anatolia, which, again, how permanently was inhabited, I've seen it discussed, so I'm not qualified to say, but essentially people here gather for some sort of religious rituals. We're not sure what they may be, whatever forgotten gods they may have worshipped or lack thereof. They gather there every once in a while. It is frequently enough frequented by people that they give it a good upkeep and ensure that it stays up for a very long time.
So how do we know that this was a religious ritual or a religious site of some sort?
Again, we're not certain, but archaeologists have generally looked at how it was built and the fact that there are many iconographic representations of things that we're not really sure what they actually are. But there are, for example, different animals that are represented there or human shapes or of that sort of thing. So we have some idea, but again, we're not certain.
Right. But it had some kind of cultural
It was some sort of cultural site that people came to often for thousands of years.
Culture is such a weird thing, man.
Yeah, people just pass
very
on
human
things, and eventually we get to, well, not hear about it, but at least look at it and say, hey, that's pretty cool.
Right.
So over the years, with the increase of agriculture, people eventually start settling down, and instead of, you know, abandoning the fields for seasons and then coming back when it's time, they decide that actually they can get a much better yield if they look at what these plants are and they just take care of them and make sure they have the right level of watering. Yeah, they ensure it. And also they can select for these crops so they can see, oh, wait, this crop is producing more seeds than normal. Okay, I'm going to plant more of this than other ones.
This is very fun. I know a little bit about, or a small tidbit of fun information about this. And that is that when people started essentially doing artificial selection in these crops, just so we can have more seeds and more tasty bits and less of the non-tasty bits, some of the weeds started to be accidentally selected for being very similar to the crops. And so now we have weeds that look almost identical to the crop that we want to eat, but are of no nutritious value to us, whether because they are poisonous or because they just don't have the seeds or the fruit that we eat. And that is just because when people started selecting for these crops and ripping out the weeds, those weeds that looked the most like the crops would not get ripped out because people would mistake them for the crops. And so we acted as a strange kind of predator to these weeds and forced them to evolve into being very similar to the crops that we were actually harvesting.
Yeah, that's an unintended side effect, but it's very cool. It's cool to know that despite that, it somehow evolved.
So we had on purpose selection made by humans and accidental selection also made by humans.
Yeah, you know, there's many accidents that we're going to see. Accidents are all over the place. So in this period, around 8,000 or 7,000 BC, people start to domesticate barley and wheat through this method that we've shown. And finally, one of the first things that are produced are beer.
Of course.
Because, yeah. And then soups made out essentially of flour and water. And finally, bread, which is much tastier than the alternative.
I prefer bread to soup. Flour soup.
Yeah, flour soup is kind of sad. But,
do you think...
You know, you can flavor it, but
do you think beer happened just because the barley or the wheat spoiled?
Probably. I don't know specifically, but it sounds like poor storage conditions would end up in beer at some point or something similar to it.
And someone was like, what is this weird liquid smelly thing? I'm going to drink it.
And there's always that one person who drinks the weird thing that nobody knows why it's there. So
lick it. See what happens.
Yeah, of course. It's you know, since the beginning of time, people have done weird stuff.
And now we have tasty food and drinks thanks to them.
Thanks to weird people.
Thank you for your sacrifice, everyone who died by poison.
Yeah, there's a lot of them around. This process is what happens in the Fertile Crescent, as I mentioned before, but all around the world we have a similar process with different local crops, so rice, maize, potatoes, all being domesticated roughly in the same period.
Was this aliens?
Or maybe people are clever.
Yeah. You know, I'm teasing you. Of course, usually it makes sense that when people, for some reason or other, have a reason to stop being nomadic and can settle down, they fairly quickly develop agriculture and some kind of farming, some kind of animal domestication, and that allows them to not have to move so much and be able to prosper, and therefore this just happens around the globe in different cultures.
Yeah, that's very nice. I mean, it changes depending on the geography, because some areas were luckier with the amount of domesticatable plants and animals you could find.
Yeah, certainly, of course.
Because, again, if you live in the Arctic, you're not going to domesticate many plants, and elephant seals are dangerous.
And, of course, there are some tribes who did very well nomadically and never settled, and that worked for them.
Yeah, it depends on the geography, what you find around yourself, whether some things are more or less convenient.
But it happened more than once, and that is, you know, curious enough.
Yeah, it was apparently people decided in many places in roughly a similar time period that, hey, settling down sounds good because we can do a lot of interesting things with it, like podcasts.
We have extra energy now and extra time, and we can invent the internet.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff.
That's how it happened, right?
Basically, yes. Okay. There's a few missteps in there, but eventually we get there. As food becomes more abundant, people found more and more settlements that are permanent. So originally, these sort of settlements are many different houses sort of clustered together so that people can, you know, look after their fields or whatever it is that they're taking care of. But there isn't really much social stratification or division between the functions of the different buildings. It's generally singular functions.
I guess your tribe was small enough that you just knew that, like, George was going to do this today, and then Anna was going to do that tomorrow, and, you know, if you're 20 people.
Yeah, the idea is that this is also, fun fact that doesn't have to do with this, is that generally the idea is that you can have about 200 people that you know reasonably well, because that is roughly the original size of human settlements. So that is roughly how many people you can know and say, oh, I remember who you are, not, oh yeah, the person with the glasses in the place.
Wait, so we can only closely-ish know 200 people?
Yes, that certain studies have been made. I'm not sure how accredited they are, but
Facebook friends.
Yeah, some of those tests they did is that it's sort of the average number of Facebook friends that people have. Because, again, it's the sort of thing where you know these people well enough that you would, like, say hi to them.
You know them by name, you know what they do, you know how you met.
You know them as, like, a person with agency, not as, oh, yeah, that driver that cut me off. It's a human person that you know.
That's very curious. But that makes sense, and it would be a logical conclusion to draw that probably that was the size of the human settlements that we
had. That is the theory.
If that is what our mind has evolved to handle.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows?
Yeah. Okay, so the nice thing is that these settlements start to grow and grow, and you go from 200 people, it starts to become large enough that people begin to specialize significantly.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's no longer, oh, I grow my food, I make my bread, I weave my clothes. It's, oh, Jeff knows how to weave particularly good cloaks, so Jeff is now the cloak maker. I know how to make especially nice bread, so I'm going to be the bread maker. Things start to separate a little bit because you have enough people that not everybody has to be constantly involved in survival.
Yeah, and you don't have to be good at everything. You can be good at one or two things. Yeah. And then someone else can fill in for you on the other ones.
Yeah, you learn how to trust people that the system will somehow work and society can grow.
This is where we f***ed up.
Yes. But hey, we'll see. So in about 5,500 BC, all this agglomeration of people starts to figure out some interesting things because, always in the Levant, of course, we begin to leave the Stone Age as the first people begin to smelt copper, which has the advantage of providing much more durable tools than stone. And the nice thing about copper is that if your copper tool breaks, you can recycle it and reuse the copper again.
Right. You just melt it again, make a new one.
Yeah. If your very nice stone tool breaks, then you just need to find a new good stone to make the tool from.
Tough luck.
Yeah, but if your copper tool breaks, well, you can just melt it down and make a new one.
Nice.
It's fine.
I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it's a good advantage about metals that are very reusable for several purposes.
I know that the metal age comes after the stone age and you have the bronze age and blah, blah, blah. But I always considered, like, aren't there metals that are not as strong as stones? Like, copper doesn't look like a particularly resistant and tough metal to me. You can bend it and you can do a lot of things to it and it kind of, you know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's why people eventually found better and better metals. But the idea is that it's much better than stone in the sense that once you have copper, it is copper. And it's not, oh, this stone had a weird vein going through it and now it snapped. I needed it. It's more reliable.
I had never thought of that part. And so I was always a bit struck that, copper came after stone and we just changed to copper, even though copper is not the most durable metal we have.
Yeah. I mean, that also happens with, a lot of people in the Americas, for example, just did very well with stone tools.
Right. They use obsidian a lot, right?
Yeah.
Just like glass.
In Central America, obsidian is a very good tool because it's so sharp that it is now modernly used as a surgical tool in certain cases.
That's so cool.
You know, you don't always need to move on to copper or that sort of thing. It's not like a clear technology tree that is going in a direction.
It was recyclable, which means you didn't have to constantly find new materials. You just had it.
It has its advantages, but you can also do well without it. It's like many technologies, they have advantages and drawbacks that maybe it might be better to pick them up later on.
Quite interesting.
So once we have all these different copper tools, the technology starts to spread across the world. And we begin to have a new development, which gives us larger and larger cities, among which is the city of Uruk, which develops in about 4,500 BC, roughly, again, which is placed in lower Mesopotamia towards the Persian Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And it is an unreasonably large city compared to all its neighbors.
Even Jericho.
Yes. I mean, Jericho was one of the first ones, but it never grew to such a size.
Maybe that's why it lasted so long.
It could be. I mean, it never formed a Jericho an empire, but...
I would like to see that alternative history.
Could be, There's many possibilities, and Chance has a role in all this.
Okay, so Uruk.
Yeah, so Uruk has had Metropolis. About 40,000 inhabitants, with at least 50,000 living in the nearby countryside, in a world where most cities struggle to have 1,000 inhabitants. Wow. Uruk is insane.
Uruk is gigantic.
Yeah, it is massive and colossal and unreasonably large.
What would you compare it to numbers for today? Obviously, today would be kind of a small city.
Yeah, that would be a small city, but I guess that the closest equivalent that I can think of right now is like metropolitan Tokyo, which has about 70 million people in one city.
That would be like the feel.
The feel of it is.
Suddenly you have villages, giant Tokyo.
Yeah, imagine going through rural Nebraska and then you just end up in New York. And it's like, oh, wow, that's big. We're also not really sure why Uruk specifically, because, you know, it's not like it's especially different from all of the towns around it.
So geographically, just inherently, it doesn't have special resources.
Not that we know of. It doesn't seem to be special, but we know that it did well for whatever reason it might be. And it formed the core of the first civilization in the world, which are the Sumerians, which were based on a whole series of different little city-states, but at least in the initial period, Uruk is the heart and soul of this. Huh. Though it doesn't really form an empire like we would think about it. It's more the cultural leader.
Yeah, but I've heard of the Sumerians. I know they were a culture and they were a civilization, so...
Yeah, so they do that sort of thing, and they slowly spread out and their culture expands and solidifies into what you would know from elementary school when you study them, usually.
Probably, yes.
Or your PhD if you're doing that, because that'd be cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, so in the next few hundred years, we see an explosion of civilizations around the world, as the Sumerians are only the first of these people, but they do open up the Bronze Age by using an alloy that's a lot better than copper. So by mixing tin with copper, you manage to find bronze, which is a lot tougher than copper itself, and it's more durable, and it's a much better material overall.
Yeah, bronze is really good.
Yeah, it's a bit rare to find because tin is hard to locate. It's much rarer than copper comparatively. But once you can make bronze, it is a very good
And again, it's recyclable.
Yeah,
so once you have it, you have it.
Yeah, it is. So,
so wait a second. Yes. I just need a bit of a recap. Have we got to Mesopotamia yet?
This is in Mesopotamia. So Mesopotamia
is the Sumerians are the culture of Mesopotamia.
So essentially, Mesopotamia is this land corresponding to modern Iraq. It's called Mesopotamia because it's the land between two rivers, which are the Tigris and the Euphrates.
We know this from school.
And yeah, this is where the Sumerians base their civilization.
Okay.
So essentially they have these two large rivers that are rather unlike the Nile. So given that they are a bit more fierce as rivers, if you can put it that way, every city needs to pay close attention to their own little backyard and ensure that the irrigation is working and that the floods don't destroy your stuff or that drought doesn't kill all your plants.
Which, for a bit of context, we're comparing it to the Nile because the civilizations that will happen around the Nile are very famously dictated by the very steady cycles of flooding that the Nile goes through, and so that people could predict and people could use for very steady agriculture and very steady sustenance. The Mesopotamia rivers, not like that at all.
No, I mean, there's a reason why Mesopotamia has the flood myth.
Right.
Because...
That's where that happens,
yes,
right?
Yes, because the rivers are terrifying and you need to make sure that everything is in order so they work and, you know, they don't abandon you to be dry or they don't destroy your house. So that is why they tend to make a lot of city-states, because it's enough work to take care of your own little thing without having to think about going to the next three towns over and taking over them. Well, we talked about the Nile, so let's talk about the Nile. In 3300 BC... the upper and lower kingdoms of Egypt are formed. So Egypt conglomerates around two different kingdoms. One in the north, the lower Egypt, and one in the south, upper Egypt.
Nice. Go
and,
Egypt.
Yeah, these are, if you have an idea of typical Egyptian iconography, how pharaohs look, you know that the pharaoh has a double crown. Well, one of these is for the lower kingdom, one of this is for the upper kingdom.
Yes, I learned this from a really, really cool pop-up book that I had when I was 8.
Pop-up books are always the best method of knowledge.
Yes. I love how there was this random vein of Egyptology mania when I was a kid, and there were a bunch of books about the topic. I don't know why.
I mean, they're cool. No, fair enough.
Yes, two crowns.
Yes, Lower so two Egypt. Crowns, Lower Egypt upper and Upper Egypt. Egypt. And 50 years later, the pharaoh Narmer is the first person to unite Egypt, and it's going to be united for pretty much most of the rest of history.
Nice.
So, you know, Egypt is a solid creation.
When did that happen? When did they unite?
About 50 years later, so in 3250 BC.
Okay.
About.
We're getting close.
Yes, we're almost at history. Also, at the same time, in the Indus Valley, civilization, arises. And, well, they're just very interesting. So look them up if you need to.
Isn't this the mysterious civilization?
Yes, they're very cool because, well, for many reasons. But they had, well, very complicated cities with plumbing and very large public buildings. And unusually enough, at least for us, they didn't appear to be much social stratification. So it seems like everybody had the same amount, roughly.
Yes.
And it didn't seem like we have any traces of conflict or war between them. We don't know why or what's going on.
It sounds like such a utopia, and yet we have very little from them.
Yeah, and the thing is, we have some writing from them, but we don't know how to read it. Firstly, because we don't know what the original language was.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really have many daughter civilizations, at least not directly. So we don't really have something we can work back from, or at least not easily.
Disappeared. It was this beautiful utopia where everyone had everything they needed and there wasn't a system of class or stratification. And then,
yeah, then
something.
We don't know. It might be that earthquakes moved the course of the Indus River, screwing up their agriculture or means of survival.
And they had to move
and
out.
And they migrated elsewhere. But again, no.
They're fascinating.
Yeah, it's very interesting, but it's frustrating how little we actually know. It would be nice to know more of that, but hey.
Indus Valley Civilization.
Yes, exactly. Sorry,
if you haven't seen the video called History of Everything, or the shorter version, which has to do more with what we're talking about here today, which is called History of the Entire World. It's a video made by Bill Wirtz. And we should put it in the show notes because it might give people bit of
it's really good
context.
It's a fun speed go through of this.
Everything explained in 20 minutes and in a very fun way.
So the Harappan Indus Valley civilization disappears at some point, but we're not there yet. So forget about it. But in the meantime, while all this was happening, in the Americas in 3200 BC, the Norte Chico civilization developed, essentially the ancestor of all the Andean civilizations. So think the Incas, which is probably the one you're more familiar with. Those are distant descendants of the Norte Chico civilization.
Excellent.
And instead, well, continuing our tour around the world, in about 2070 BC, the legendary Xia dynasty is born in China. Again, they are semi-mythical, but we know that along the Yellow River, there are certain people who are building cities and doing the whole spiel that we had before.
Civilization happened.
Yes, civilization happens, and this is where all the Chinas come from, and all the civilizations that derive their cultural roots from China. For
example. Is this also 3200 BC?
This is about 2070 BC.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it takes a while longer, but get there. While the last cradle of civilization is the Olmecs in 1600 BC, which are the first civilization in Central America, and well, from them, all the ones that you know of. So Teotihuacan, the Mayans, the Aztecs, all those nice people, they derive from the Olmecs thousands of years later, because time is a long thing.
So it took, about 2,000 to 3,000 years for all the starting civilizations to get going.
Essentially, yeah. Everybody, within their own time, based on the local conditions, developed their own different cultural bases.
From Uruk in the 4500 all the way to the 1600s and the Olmecs.
Yeah, essentially. So there's a lot of stuff happening all around the world, a lot of interesting things, but we're going to zoom back into Mesopotamia because that's where part of our scene is going to be set. You might have noticed, okay, I haven't talked about Iran, but this is important.
Right.
This stuff, it matters.
We left Mesopotamia in the Bronze Age.
So we left it just as the Bronze Age started. So after the birth of Uruk, we have that many other city-states rise up in the area. And people invent cuneiform writing because it's much easier to keep records if you have a systematized way of reading and writing and recording information. That, you know, originally it started as a very practical thing, but it eventually develops into literature and arts and songs. And
conversation.
Conversations and mail complaints about quality of copper. That sort of thing.
Please tell me about that.
Yeah, essentially we have a very ancient complaint about the quality of copper that, essentially was a complaint letter that a merchant sent to his copper provider saying, you promised me copper, I want a refund.
We have a bad Yelp review.
Yeah, essentially.
And that is one of the first writings we have.
Yes, that is one of the first things we have.
That is hilarious.
But the absolute oldest one that we have comes from about 3200 BC and is the so-called Kushim tablet, which says 29,086 measures barley, 37 months, Kushim. It's not very riveting stuff, but it's the first bit of quote-unquote literature that we have.
There's a bit of writing.
Yes. So from there to Ferdowsi, just wait 4,000 years. 5,000 years, actually, and then we'll get there.
Well, but like you said, it was used as a practical tool.
Yeah,
just, you know, to count how many things you had, to count the things that people owed you, to know how the city was doing, and then, you know.
Yeah, so it starts as that, and then eventually we get to a lot of interesting things later on.
Also, is Kushim a name?
Kushim, we don't know if it's a name. It might be an... I mean, it could be multiple things. It could either be a personal name, as in, I'm Bob... or it could be like a title, like secretary, like a stamp.
How do we know it's pronounced Kushim?
Not a scholar, but we know from the cuneiform, since you can read it, you can sort of extract from there what it means. Generally, pronunciation is figured out either through the fact that early Sumerian cuneiform starts, well, first of all, by making drawings, and then it evolves into puns, essentially.
Yes.
So, like, watermelon is literally the symbol for water and melon.
Yes.
Not literally, this is an example, but yeah.
Yeah.
And eventually, the symbol gets maintained in different cultures that have new languages, so the pun is lost.
Hmm.
But if you slowly work your way back to Sumerian, you can figure it out and say, oh, okay, so this is how it's pronounced, even though it doesn't sound like it.
Which is funny, because we still do that in languages today.
Yeah.
If you don't believe me, just look up some literal translations of German names for animals, and you will be surprised.
Yeah.
Of how many water pigs we have, and shield frog.
Yeah, shield frog is a particularly good one. So yeah, the cuneiform for shield frog is shield frog.
I see. It's a shield and a frog.
Yeah, that's it.
Nice.
The pun doesn't translate if you say turtle, but you know, if you know that turtle is written as a shield and a frog.
So, okay, that's very interesting.
So different centuries passed with many years of long forgotten politics that goes on. We don't know what happens, but we have a little bit of information, mostly through king lists, which aren't super illuminating, but it's nice to have. Yeah. And we know that Uruk, however, is the hegemon in this period. Culturally, it is the one that leads Mesopotamia.
Makes sense. Overall. It's a metropolis. Most people are
essentially there. It loses its advantage after a while, but still, it's very important. In fact, this is also when we get in the king list of Uruk a certain king Gilgamesh, which is the hero from the myth.
I know him.
Yes, is the hero from the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is, I believe, the oldest epic that we have.
The oldest, like, long tail.
Yes, the oldest surviving epic. So we know that Gilgamesh lived sometime between 2800 and 2500 BC, and he is credited, at least by the poem, as he who built the walls of Uruk.
That is
very cool. Yeah. Spoilers for a 4,000-year-old epic poem, but the point of the poem in the end is that achieving immortality physically isn't the point of it. It's not achievable, but you can achieve it through your works, and the poem begins and ends with a description of the walls of Uruk.
Oh, that is so clever. It's essentially, you can't be immortal yourself, but your actions may outlive you, so you can leave your mark on the world.
Work that things improve.
Humans really don't change, do they?
No, still, stories are good and we enjoy them, which is nice.
If you've ever been worried, if you're a writer or a creative of any kind, and you've ever been worried that you're not original enough, you don't have to be. We are not original.
Nothing original has ever been done, so don't worry, it's fine. After the time of Gilgamesh, we move away from the time of heroes, if you will, into a time of more grounded history. Because after Gilgamesh, we get kings that have an actual reasonable length of reign, and we know more about them. We have letters, we have monuments, that sort of thing, which makes it easier to ground them historically. And we know that the influence of Uruk starts to wane, and new powers begin to rise in the region. Most importantly of all of these is Akkad, under Sargon the Great, who comes to the throne in 2334 BC. Now, the Akkadian Empire becomes the first empire in history, as Sargon takes control of all of Mesopotamia, the first man to ever do this, and yes, and manages to send expeditions all the way into Iran and Syria.
So it's the first empire.
Yes, it's the first empire. It's the first state that manages to encompass different cultures and it becomes this large conglomerate of peoples.
You go, Akkadians.
Also, interestingly enough, just as a fact, that Sargon's daughter is the first woman to write poetry.
Oh!
The first recorded poetry is from her, and she's also, well, a woman, which is cool.
First poet, a woman. You will never believe it. Tell it to the 19th century historians, they'll go crazy.
Yes, they'll be mad and unhappy.
What was her name?
Yes, so Sargon's daughter's name is Enhidwana, and she was a priestess of the god Nanna, which is an excellent god.
And who was the god of what?
Nanna, I can't remember if the god of the moon or the sun, but Nanna is cool.
An astral god.
Yes, it's one of the important gods, is the point.
Okay. So hey, you poets out there, leave an offering to Enhidwana whenever you feel like you need some inspiration.
So I mentioned Sargon's empire. How long does that last? Not long.
Oh.
It lasts, essentially, by the time of his grandson, it's basically in pieces. Because though he had invented empires, he hadn't invented how to keep them together.
I feel like we still haven't invented how to keep them together.
Yes, keeping together empires is difficult, and it takes a long time. And,
well, the bigger it is, the more different cultures you'll have, the more different viewpoints you'll have, and the harder it will be to communicate with all of it. Nowadays, we have technology, which makes the world significantly smaller, because you can get to people fast. But especially back then.
Yeah, if the fastest speed is someone running, it's going to be difficult to hold everything together.
Wait, weren't there horses?
Sort of. I mean, horses were domesticated.
Wait, we haven't got horses yet?
Some people do. I don't think they're very common in Mesopotamia at this time.
Wow. So yeah, the fastest speed is someone running.
Yeah. A person running is your high-speed internet.
Your high-speed internet.
So yeah, not a good time.
Right, so the empire...
So the empire does not survive long after his death, but it's going to be the first in a long line of empires who are going to rule the region. So not only that, but the Akkadian language is going to be the lingua franca of Mesopotamia until the early Iron Age.
Wow.
And importantly enough, future empires are going to do what they can to anchor their legitimacy to Sargon.
Right.
Much in the way that European empires, for example, try to link their legitimacy to the Roman Empire, saying, I'm the true successor to Rome because...
And the Romans tried to link it to Alexander the Great.
Yeah, and so on and so forth. Sargon is that for Mesopotamia.
OG.
Everybody is going to say, oh, yes, because I am the 16th grandson, 3 times removed of Sargon, so that means I have the right to rule this place.
I have the blood of the gods.
That's kind of the point.
Yeah, we keep doing that, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's been going on for a
while. That is fascinating. Following what the Epic of Gilgamesh taught us of how you can become immortal by your acts on the world and not by yourself, one would say that the Akkadian Empire lasted way more than 2 or 3 generations if the language was used for how many years?
A couple thousand, at least. So it is a long tale, yes. Even though the empire itself didn't last very long, its effect on the consciousness of the area was quite strong. So moving on after the fall of the Akkadian Empire, there are a series of different cities that become hegemonic in the region, so they try to follow what Akkad had done. But the one that is most relevant to us for the next dozen episodes,
right?
More than that, actually. But anyway, is the rise of the city of Babylon.
I know that one.
Yes, under King Hammurabi, which is going to lead this formerly almost irrelevant city to ruling all of Mesopotamia.
Yes.
I'm researching other stuff, I'm sorry. But yeah.
Spoilers.
Yes, spoilers. Macedonia comes into the story. But it's going to rule all of Mesopotamia in 1755 BC. And also, another reason you might remember Hammurabi is that Hammurabi's code is one of the first law codes that we have still to this day. It's not the first one in total, but it was influential enough that we still remember Hammurabi, and we have a nice stele with the code on it that says, well, generally, it's if you cut someone's hand off, you get your hand cut off. It's not, you know, it's not high political theory, but...
It's a few rules, you know.
Yeah, it's rules that you know that if you cut off a rich person's hand, this is what happens. If you cut off a poor person's hand, this is what happens. If you cut off a slave's hand, this is what happens. At least it's spelled out.
Fun
is
stuff.
The point. It's not just somebody deciding, yeah, sure, this'll do.
I miss the utopia of the Indus Valley civilization.
You know, they might have been horrible in different reasons. We don't know.
We don't have that much.
We don't know enough.
When did Babylon happen?
1755 BC.
Oh, I thought that was when Hammurabi ruled.
I mean, it was still around. It was in the area.
Okay.
But that's when it becomes important enough that we care. So the interesting thing about Babylon is that it's very important. Much like Akkad, the Babylonian Empire doesn't, or at least this one, doesn't last very long, but it has a long echo. So the city of Babylon is going to be very important culturally for a few thousand years. And after that, funnily enough, it's going to migrate north and change name until becoming the modern city of Baghdad.
Interesting.
So if you just go a bit downstream compared to Baghdad, you find the ruins of Babylon, and you just go through the ruins of other cities that essentially just followed up north.
That is so cool. I wonder if it was because of the river changing.
I don't know if it was the river changing. I think it might have been just people wanting to build a new city, but wanting to keep it next to the old, good, cool one.
I see.
And then just going, we'll meet all of these cities. I think all of them are going to be capitals of our empires at some point. So.
So they're except still standing. Babylon, it's not ruins. And
I mean, Baghdad is the only one that is still standing.
Well,
the other ones
today,
the other ones are ruins. You can go there. You can find it.
But when the people made the new city, the older city was not destroyed.
No, not yet. So usually when the new city was built, the older one was important. And somebody just wanted to build a new city for whatever reason they might have had. And then the old city essentially shrunk. Shrunk while the new one grew, and then it continued as an
echo. So it did move like a caterpillar.
Yeah,
upwards.
It's sort of like a slowly inching upriver city.
Throughout like 1,000 years.
Yeah, through 3,000 years, which is a long, long time.
Would love to see the time lapse of that.
That would be fun. That would be a good thing to go through.
Someone animate that, please.
Yeah, that would be excellent. So this city is going to be interesting. We'll see it for a very long time. But yeah, in the following centuries, we see the rise of a new power in the region, which is the last one we're going to introduce, essentially, which is that of Assyria, which is centered in the cities of Ashur, from which the name of the state, and Nineveh, which manages to take over the city of Babylon in 1220 BC and become a sort of empire. It controls a large proportion of Mesopotamia, goes a little bit into the Levant, and it begins to be the new power brokers in the area.
New empire just dropped.
Yes, new empire just dropped. Good stuff to come. The Assyrians were a very warlike people, noted for their brutality, and managed to become the main power in Mesopotamia, but just in time for the Bronze Age collapse, unfortunately for them.
Ooh, they timed it badly.
Yeah, that wasn't great timing, but hey. Because, yeah, in around 1200 BC, a complicated intersection of invasions and environmental factors caused a whole domino effect that led to the collapse of most Bronze Age society in the Near East, among which the Hittites, the Mycenaeans, what remained of the Minoans, and the only civilization who survived were the Egyptians and the Assyrians, but they were essentially mortally wounded, because Egypt never again returned to the state it once was. It never returned to becoming what is the equivalent of a world power. It became a still relevant state. It was still relevant for a very long time, but it was no longer the state that was in the area.
Essentially, they escaped with very bad wounds and they went into hiding because it was hard.
Yeah, they went to lick their wounds and they said, ow, that was painful. Let's not do that again, please.
This was always so fascinating to me because I feel like for all this history that I studied in elementary school and in high school, this was never properly explained to me. The fact that you have the prehistory, then you have the start of history, the cradle civilizations, Mesopotamia, Egypt, all of the things that we essentially have talked about so far in the podcast. And you have the myths, the first myths that we have. We have the Gilgamesh epic, and we have what some Occidental background people might be more familiar with, the myth of the War of Troy.
Yeah, essentially.
And you have all of these myths with all of these heroes. And this is supposed to happen within this period. And then the Bronze Age collapse happens.
Yes.
And everything gets wiped out.
Yeah, it's all gone. Essentially, the Bronze Age collapse is what cuts away the mythical past from the historical past, at least in a Greek context.
Like, am I the only one who thinks this is weird? Like,
it is very weird.
Also,
very
why wasn't it properly taught in school? Like, I did not know this happened until you told me, hey, did you know that all of these civilizations essentially disappeared and then we started from a dark age?
Yeah, it was. A lot was going on, yeah. And the interesting thing is that around when the Bronze Age collapse happens is when we estimate that the historical Trojan War happened.
Yeah.
So there are also hypotheses that this might be connected to the people who destroyed a lot of these civilizations. But
well,
again,
yes, because we always have a bit of like, what? How much is myth and how much is actually based in history?
Yeah, because
right?
it's interesting to find a historical basis
Troy.
For the myth. They have found Troy, they've found the layers of it. And they know that, oh yeah, there was a Troy destroyed around this time in history.
So Troy was a city that existed. Now, if Achilles was there with Patroclus and with Hector,
it's unlikely that things happened exactly as the story says, but something vaguely similar enough happened that somebody decided to make a story about it.
And then everyone forgot how to write.
Yeah, in Greece, writing was forgotten and they essentially went into a dark age, not because it was, wasn't great, but it wasn't especially bad, but it's a dark age because we don't have any writing, so we don't know what happens.
That is just...
We have a lot of myths and people telling stories and...
Oh, my brain. Like, what is this?
Yes, just... it is a lot of stuff.
So Egypt and the Assyrians did survive.
So Egypt and the Assyrians survive, but suffer.
Right.
So Assyria entered a slow decline at the beginning of the Iron Age. So in these centuries, the technology of iron begins to spread in the Near East because, hey, it's easier to find and just better than bronze.
Yeah.
So it is something that begins to spread around.
Get on with the times.
So Assyria enters a slow decline, but is soon revitalized under a series of very capable kings, such as Sargon II, who made Assyria the dominant power not only in Mesopotamia, but the whole of the area.
Nice.
So at this point, Assyria is the power player in the area that you need to contend with if you want to become a great power. And our protagonists are going to have to contend with it quite a lot.
Interesting.
Which leads us to about our starting year of 700 BC.
Oh.
And just to give you an overview, in the meantime, in the Mediterranean, the Greek and Phoenician colonies have begun to flourish. So the Greeks are founding a lot of colonies in the south of Italy and Sicily, around the Black Sea and Asia Minor.
The Mediterranean region.
A lot of the Mediterranean, while the Phoenicians are building a lot of colonies in the northern coast of Africa, around Spain. Also, they're dividing Sicily a bit with the Greeks. And it is around this period that the Phoenicians found a small city known as Carthage in modern Tunisia. In the traditional date, I believe, is 786 BC. While in the similar time, a small village on the shores of the Tiber is founded in 753 BC. And the guy founding it decides that, hey, Rome sounds like a good name. Let's build a city here. Let's see what happens. It's going to be a fun time.
We have Carthage. We have Rome. I know those.
Yes.
They're fun.
The stage is set. Just wait like 500 years and then it'll beat the crap out of each other.
The Greeks are also there.
The Greeks are doing things. But what's happening in Iran at this time? Where our protagonists are going to be from.
Right.
We haven't been talking about them. Sorry. The thing is that since until now, they are in prehistory.
Right.
So they're not telling us anything. Not telling us much. We don't really have any large inscriptions saying, oh, I am king so-and-so. I did these things. We mostly hear of them through the Assyrians saying, hey, we went and raided some barbarians in the east.
Right.
So we brought back
some
cool
from
stuff.
From the Assyrians.
Yeah, we know from other people in general who are communicating with them, but we don't have their story. So how do we know about them? So what is going on? First of all, in the southwest of the region, which is close to the mouth of the Tigris and the Euphrates, so on along the Persian Gulf. We have the Elamite culture, which is centered in the cities of Susa and Anshan, which are very ancient cities and are going to be important a little bit later on. And these people were in close contact with the rest of Mesopotamia and frequently go to war with the cities around the area. We have a lot of documentation about this. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting, but not what we're going to be focusing on. But yeah, they managed to go to war with several of these cities, such as Ur, for example, which they even sack a few times. And so the Elamites are often known in Mesopotamian stories. They're often known in that context. However, our protagonists come from much further north, up in the Pontic-Caspian steppe, which is on the northern coast of the Black Sea.
Okay.
Where there live the Proto-Indo-European people, who are likely to be the ones who domesticated the horse, which is, well, interesting in itself, but the more relevant part of this for us is that they are going to start migrating everywhere. Because somewhere between 4000 and 3000 BC, these Proto-Indo-European people begin to migrate in two groups. One of them spreads towards Europe to form the ancestors of most European languages except Basque.
Right.
So the ancestors of the German language, all the Latin languages, all the Slavic languages, all these people somehow come culturally through to the Proto-Indo-Europeans.
Well, yeah, that is very fun to see. All languages have a common root, even languages that seem very far apart, because they all come from this group of people.
Yeah, you can, again, there are many lists online that you can look up which are interesting, but you can see that there are certain comparisons, like, for example, sister and soror in Latin, and Schwester in German. All these things are similar because they come from
one language. Cool.
So that's very nice.
So part of them go to Europe.
Part of them go towards Europe, but the ones that we're interested in now, the Indo part of the Proto-Indo-European, head eastwards. So these are the so-called Indo-Iranian peoples, also known as the Aryans, but not those Aryans.
Not those Aryans.
These are actual people. This is just what they call themselves. So they move somewhere into the Iranian plateau, and there they stay for a while, they develop their culture. And then sometimes between 1800 and 1600 BC, there is a further split. So the Indo-Aryans go and travel to northern India, where they form the basis of the Vedas and the Sanskrit language all the languages that descend from that in that area. While on the other side, we have the Iranian peoples who remain into eastern Iran and begin to develop their own distinctive culture. So it is interesting to see that they are quite closely related if you look at the older elements of the religion and older elements of the languages. That is very fun to look at and find the comparisons. So we have our Iranian people who remain in the eastern area of Iran, where they begin to form their own religion, which is related to Hinduism, but different. And it is roughly in this period. The precise dates are not precise. We do not know. I've read many, many different accounts. I'm not qualified to tell you which is more correct, but the Zoroastrian religion starts to form across these centuries, which is, we'll talk about it later on, but essentially there's a reform movement of the traditional Iranian religion, which focuses around this primary god, Ahura Mazda.
Uh-huh.
So around 800 BC is when we see the action and what's essentially going to spur the creation of the first states in this area. Because the Medes, the Persians, and the Parthians, who came from this eastern Iranian area, migrate to western Iran and occupy the region that are going to be later known as Media, Persia, and Parthia, as you would assume. And it's here that they come into view of our history, with the Assyrians and the Babylonians and all these sort of people starting to talk about, hey, these people are coming from the east. This is what they're doing. We also have some tell from the Elamites, whose territory is going to be invaded by the Persians, who eventually take over Anshan. And the Persians will begin to call themselves King of Anshan, and we will meet them later on. So this is the stage being set, at least for the first episode, when we are going to look into Media at the first semi-mythical foundation of the state there.
Because it's very long ago, and so you know.
Yes, the problem with this is that the discipline of history is invented about 200 years after the events.
Right.
So
everything before, stories.
I mean, it's stories and monuments by kings saying what they did. We only get 200 years later, somebody, I'll talk about much more in detail in the next episode, but somebody who's trying to figure out a story and say, okay, this is where the Persians came from. This is what stories the Persians tell about themselves. I'm going to tell you what these stories are.
Right.
So this is where we're going to get Diakes, our first king, who is going to be a Median king and, according to the legends, to the stories, the first king the Medians ever had.
Interesting.
So we're going to find out how he gets to do that and what his whole deal is. And it's going to be very interesting and fun.
There's been so many different cultures and civilizations that we talk about. Are there any maps that I can look at?
Yes, I'm going to upload some maps, so
I'm saying this for the audience, but also I'm saying this for me because right now I don't know anymore.
Yeah, there is a lot. I'm going to upload some maps so people can have a look and know roughly what's going on. I mean, it's going to be just a slideshow, essentially, of empires and things going back and forth as time flows like water, but it's interesting stuff to know.
Yeah, it's been very enlightening. I'm very, very excited to start now that we have a bit of the field where things will be happening.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot more straightforward once we get to the people and we don't jump 1,000 years in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot more straightforward. Now we need to tell you about the categories that we're going to use to rate people.
Right. I actually don't even remember them, so please
tell me. Good refresher for everyone. So, overall, we're going to give these kings points out of 100.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody's going to get very close to 100 for reasons you'll see.
It is a good round number.
We'll see. 100 is a good, nice number to work with. We're both going to be giving points out of 10 for most of these, except one, which is going to be a bit different. But for all these things, we're going to give points out of 10, and through our magical calculation spreadsheet, they will be transformed into the final points.
The magical calculator machine.
Yes. Good thinking rock. So the first category is going to be final moments.
Uh-huh.
And this is going to be points out of 10, so the sum of our points is going to be
hacked. We're starting with a bright one.
Yes.
With a beautiful, positive very good one.
I mean, if we're going to end it on the death with these people, might as well judge how interesting it is. So it's going to be how interesting it is, how cool it is, you know. Is it somebody just dying in their bed?
Is it memorable?
After a long, satisfying life and being like, I mean, no, it's okay. Or is it going to be Caesar being stabbed under the statue of his greatest enemy by people he thought were his friends, which is a cool way to go out.
Hard to top that
one. Or Emperor Leo going out in a church, hitting people with a massive cross while he's being stabbed.
I'm sorry.
That's cool. Listen to Totalis Rancium. It's awesome.
Right.
Good stuff.
Love their podcast.
But yeah, so that is final moments. Next, we move on to battle hardness, which is essentially going to be out of 20, first of all.
Oh.
And it, essentially, how good were these people at fighting? This includes both personal fighting, both, you know, choosing good generals to go out and do stuff. You know, it's both, did you wrestle a lion or did you defeat a massive army? Did you conquer an empire?
Were you victorious?
Yeah, it's a lot of different
personal
things.
Or in
the yeah, whether personal battle. or in delegation, bigger. Essentially, it's going to be this sort of value. And we're going to have a lot of this. There are many, many kings. there's a lot of fighting, guys. It's a lot.
You know, it's history, it's ancient history. Yeah.
And generally, if you're called the great, you're probably going to have some points in here. That's generally how it's assigned. But, you know, we'll be the judge of that. We'll
is
see
this it, foreshadowing? It. Yes, it is.
It absolutely. Is a lot of foreshadowing. There's are so many of the greats. Oh, God. But, yeah.
I can see the pain of doing all the research. Are you okay?
I'm fine.
Do you need some therapy? I can
probably. This is going to be my therapy. It'll work out.
Okay, good. But I am not a licensed therapist. I do not respond for any harm that might come from this.
So next category is going to be scheminess, which is also out of 20.
Oh, I like this one.
And this is how schemey are you? So the idea is, did you orchestrate a fancy palace coup to become king? Or was it handed to you on a silver platter? You never had to do anything.
Did you plan how to murder your worst enemy so that he thought his mother did it?
Yeah, that sort of thing. You know, did you do that well, or were you somebody who was doing things very by the books, just straight and true, nothing especially strange? Yeah. So there's going to be a lot of scheming, but some people will decide that they don't actually need it, that they're doing better without it, that they're straightforward.
Fair, and
don't
honest.
Need to, don't need to randomly murder people in dark alleys. It's going to be fine. So that is scheminess. And there's a similar one, but it is different. And
different
that is shock that factor. Yes. Different enough that we decided to put it in.
Shock factor.
That is shock factor, which is also out of 20. And the idea here is, how shocking are these people in general? So, you know, it doesn't have to be necessarily scheme-y. You can still order the execution of your best friend for no reason other than they wore a robe you didn't like. You can do that.
Seems a bit out of proportion.
Yeah, you know. Shock factor, yeah, is anything that would make you say, oh, wow, what went wrong here? Oh, no, oh, no.
What happened? I feel like our 21st century minds are going to be quite more shocked than people back then were.
I mean, fair enough, but it's going to be interesting to judge this in the specific cases because we're going to have to weigh how much we should be shocked by things that they wouldn't consider shocking. So, for example, mild spoilers, incest is going to be a little bit common, but it's normal there, so... What
are you shocked?
We'll see. But then also there's a vice versa that maybe they might have been shocked about things that we think, oh,
that's just normal.
Why? Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, what is going on?
People go to therapy, it's fine.
Yeah, it's just, it's a bit weird. You know, maybe somebody wearing the wrong shoes is like, oh, huge scandal, but like it's fine, wear whatever
shoes.
Yeah, it's okay. So that is shock factor.
Interesting.
Next we're gonna have Erin Shine. Why Erin Shine? Well, Iran, or Iran Shah, is the name of the country that at least the Sassanids, which are people, one of the many Persian empires, are going to call their country.
Mm-hmm.
So Erin Shine is essentially, how good were you for Persia? How good were you for the empire? And again, this is where the foreign ruler points are going to go into, because, you know, if you've been a good ruler for your country but terrible for Persia, you
bad
get
points.
Low points here.
Yes.
So for Erin Shine, we're going to give points out of 20, and we'll see how good they were in general. So this is sort of an overall success round.
Did you move the empire forward, or did you push it back?
Yeah, move it forward, push it back, or did you manage to just
maintain
keep it going as it was, which is always a good thing to have. You know,
yeah,
not
we
very
tend
impressive,
to ignore that, and honestly, those are the best periods usually.
Yeah, those are the ones you'd want to live through normally, when nothing exciting is happening and you're okay.
You mean you can live through not unprecedented times?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, you can live through not unprecedented times, like, you know, a plague or that sort of thing.
Yeah, or economic crash.
Yeah, that's fine.
War.
Famine, pestilence. All the horsemen of the apocalypse.
We're fine, guys. We got this. Hang in there.
And next category is going to be face of faces.
Ah,
which is going to be out of 5 overall. And it's essentially us judging what these people look like, if they are interesting, if they look like what we think they would.
Do I fancy them?
Basically. So we're going to look up some reference images and see, okay, we're going to find one on which we want to rate these people. There's a few kings so far that don't really have an image, which is unfortunate. But,
sad.
You know, if we can, we'll try and find a contemporary one. If we can't, we'll find... closest thing possible. There's some more modern etchings, a lot of Victorian stuff, but yeah.
Oh, Victorian's fun. So obviously this will be totally absolutely objective, and our words should be taken and quoted in any future studies that bring up the likenesses of these people. And I am totally joking, please don't take me seriously. This is going to be, if anything, the most subjective of all of the points that we'll be judging.
Yes, this is the nice silly round where you look, haha, they had a funny beard.
Yes. Essentially, does this person look like I imagined them to look?
Yeah, or, you know, do they have something interesting enough in their appearance that's like, oh, I'm going to remember this person.
That mustache.
Or is it just, oh yeah, it's the 16th person with the same face. I'm done.
The sculptor wasn't...
Yeah, it happens.
Paid enough.
Then the last point is going to be lengthiness, which is... out of 5, and it's, we're not going to rate anything, it's just the amount of years these people rule divided by 10.
This one is objective.
Yeah, this one is the most objective one that you can make.
It's just mathematical.
Yeah. And we decided dividing by 10 because the most long-lived people are going to live rule 50 years at least.
Okay.
And the longest one in total is going to be 70 years, but that's just a one-off.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's fair enough. If you're going to rule for 70 years, you deserve some credit for it.
Yeah, I'm excited to find out who it is who lives 70 years.
Very cool. Looking forward
to
telling...
Who rules 70 years, not lives 70 years.
Very cool. Looking forward to telling you in 2023 or 24 or 25. We'll see, whenever we get to it.
Right.
It's going to be in a while.
Hope we make it.
Yeah, we should. We'll be fine. So once we have all these different categories, we add up the points and we get the points out of 100. And as I mentioned, so we'll see if they are worthy of being a Shahanshah or if they're just a Shahanah and will be thrown out into the desert to starve.
Oh, how sad.
There's worse ways to go. It's
That's fair.
We're going to describe much worse ways to go.
Oh, fun.
There's a lot of stuff over here.
Looking forward to that.
Yes.
I think. Right, so we'll have a list of King of Kings.
Yes, and
even though technically all of them are King of Kings.
Technically all of them are King of Kings. Some of them will be King of the Universe, which is an excellent title.
That is very... I mean, I guess you can get off that pedestal that you put yourself on whenever, sir.
Yeah, you know, if nobody's going to stop you, I mean...
Not even the known universe, just the universe in general. Yeah, everything. Just everything.
Yes, aliens, watch out.
Hubris.
Yes. And at the end, once we have all these King of Kings, we're going to put them one against each other and find who is the kingiest of kings.
Interesting. I'm very excited. But I'm most excited about getting to know them because I know nothing about them.
Yes, I'm very excited to point out all of these different people. There is a lot of stuff to go through, a lot of drama. It's going to be fun. We'll see.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much again, Umberto, for doing all the research, putting all the work, and being such a fun person to talk to and just have this conversation. I love when you explain things to me. I love learning from the things you have to share. So thank you so much.
Yes, hopefully everybody else will enjoy it as well. And yeah,
right.
We're going to be here.
We're just starting this, so I guess let us know. Leave wherever you're listening to this. I don't know yet where we will be posting it, but leave some
Most
kind
places.
Of comment or review.
Yeah, write to us in our general social pages. Tell us
what you
think. Give us feedback.
Yeah, please.
And we'll see how it goes.
Do
and,
we suck? Maybe we suck. I don't know. Do we suck already? It's episode one. I feel like...
Yeah, it's episode zero. It's not even one. It's fine. Doesn't count.
We're professionals.
Yeah, it's okay. We can look back on this in years and years and see laugh at how bad we were. So we'll see.
We hopefully will improve.
Yeah, we're going to improve. It'll be fine. We have... I mean, we have about 90 kings to improve with.
90?
So. Yes, it's a lot.
Okay, that's good fine.
That's if we stop at season one.
I was going to say that was at least like 3 seasons or 4, and that's just season one.
No.
What am I
The good
doing?
Thing is that season two ends in the 1970s, so that's fine.
Oh, wow. I did not expect this to go all the way to modern times.
We'll see if we go there, but... For now, we're going to stop in the 600s AD.
Okay, wonderful. Hey, if you, listener, made it all the way to here, congratulations. Thank you for listening. That was wonderful. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, hope you enjoyed it. Hope you had a good time, and hope you'll join us for the next one when we'll actually start rating somebody. We'll rate Diocles, the first king of the Medians, and we'll find out how he got there. You'll meet our friend Herodotus, and I'll tell you all about him. Because he's going to be around with us for a dozen episodes, and it's going to be a good time. And yeah, so I hope you enjoyed this, and please join us next time.
Yeah, see you next time. Goodbye.
Bye.